All right, so this time of year, we like to offer a special talk on exploring climate change or the climate crisis in relationship to our Dharma practices. And so this year, I wanted to talk about wise intention in relationship to that. And after I had pretty much written my whole talk, I looked at what I did last year, and guess what? I also wrote about climate change and wise intention. So the good news is it's a completely different talk. Different things came out as I explored it. So hopefully it will be still fresh and applicable to your practice. So we talk about wise view or wise intention in particular. It's part of the second fold of the Eightfold Path, right? So that's part of the Four Noble Truths, and there's that last fold is the Eightfold Path. And the second fold is wise intention. And this is really an important link between our wise view and our actions, our wise actions. And I think it was very intentional that the Buddha put it in that place there. Because our underlying view, our underlying assumptions of how we are in the world, our underlying spiritual perspective forms this view that then our intention gets behind, gives voice to, gives energy to, and then our actions express that. So our actions really are expressed through our intention, and the intention is created through our view. So if you find that our actions are off or in a harmful way in some way or unskillful, it's often helpful to pause and step back and say, okay, what's the intention and what's the underlying view that's driving those? Because there's always some view, whether it's conscious or not. It's still operating and shows up in how we speak, how we move our bodies, what we write, and what we think, our thoughts also. So intentionality, this wise intention is such a critical link. And so that's why I wanted to highlight it, particularly around something that's so pertinent and urgent in our day and time as climate change. Because when we look at how we respond to climate change, we can often see that our actions are off. Certainly on a global level, in terms of the government level, and even going down to our personal levels. I know some people in this meeting think about climate change every day and what they can do to help with that and make very conscious choices in their lives. And other ones, as including myself, sometimes we just get caught in the day-to-day urgency, all the fires that have to be put out and the things to do. And we forget about this bigger thing that's slowly unfolding. And so when our actions aren't lined up with, what our beliefs are, there's something that's going on. There's something with our view and our intention, which isn't quite lined up. And so learning how to reestablish wise view and then wise intention with that then allows our actions to flow in a wise way. So what is wise view? Wise view, simply said, is understanding deeply the Four Noble Truths, understanding the origination and the cessation of suffering, of dukkha. Another way to say it, it's understanding this construct and this belief in an isolated, solid sense of self. And then seeing through that illusion, seeing how that is just another thought or concept. One way we could express this is seeing the sense of unity or sense of oneness or wholeness or inner connection. That's a natural expression when we stop believing in this isolated self. We just see that self as a utility, as something that arises and is also passing away. But we don't place our identity in that sense of self. Our identity goes someplace else, and it goes toward this sense of interconnection, of oneness. And so when we have a glimpse or a deep seeing of this, we start to have the effect of seeing the interconnection of all things, of all beings. We see the world and ourselves as really as one thing that's inseparable, really as one thing. And this isn't an idea, it's not an idea or a concept, but a direct knowing, a direct seeing. And in this way, our actions naturally flow from that. This includes our relationship to the natural world. includes our relationship to the environment, to the earth. On the other hand, with the illusion of self that's really believed in, that's unexamined and taken at face value, when our identity is really located in that sense of self, separation is the natural way that we see the world and ourselves in that. We look out and see the world filled with separations, with things which are us and things which are not us, the self and the other, the me and the other. Other people, animals, nature, the earth itself is something that's outside of who we are. It's not related to us. And then a different set of actions flow from that as a natural assumption. Well, it makes sense. This is not me, so I can relate to you differently than that. So another way of describing wise view, and this is how we'll kind of hold it for this evening's exploration, is of interconnection, that sense of unity, this non-division, non-duality. And so tonight we'd like to explore this connection, or this lack of connection with the earth and the natural world, and how that relates to climate change, and how through wise intention and the support of wise action then leads to our actions, which are wise, and lead to hopefully the diminishing and easing of this changing climate. So wise intention has three elements that we'll touch on and explore, three aspects. So the first is renunciation, in the sense of letting go of releasing, right? Particularly things which aren't serving us, but also things which are really driven by our greed and our hatred. The second wise intention is that of non-ill will, right? So of non-hatred, of non-aversion. And then finally, the last one is of non-harm, the wise intention of non-harm, that our actions are based in this non-harm. So let's start with renunciation. Now, when we see through this sense of self and we see it as just as an illusionary thing that's not the end statement of ourselves and other people, that we open to something that's much broader, we see a state of oneness. There's also a deep sense of completeness, that nothing needs to be added or changed or subtracted from this moment. There's a sense of complete sufficiency. The inner sufficiency, the inner completeness is also very clear, very palpable. There's a deep sense of sufficiency, of enoughness. You know, a few weeks ago, we talked about that inner lack that so many of us struggle with, and how that leads to habits, leads to different types of addictions. But from this direct seeing, from this direct realization of the perspective, renunciation becomes very natural, becomes almost effortless, because there's not that inner lack that so often we're clinging and grabbing to try to overcome, to try to fulfill. We're not operating from that inner lack. So then we're not trying to take, we're not always having to seek and take. So renunciation is a natural expression of that. You know, looking at the natural world, you know, when we're in that, you know, that may be very accessible for all of us, just going out and feeling the peace of the natural surroundings, you know, feeling the breeze on your cheek and the warmth of the sun, sound of the birds, the delight of spring coming on. And if you're able to just set aside your cares, your to-do list, and just relax into the moment, you see, there's nothing that needs to be changed. There's nothing that you ask or need for the earth. It's a simple relationship. This is the relationship of renunciation, of simply allowing another thing to be itself. Now, the opposite of renunciation is, we could say, greed, desire, that lack, that hungriness that's never satisfied or fulfilled. And it's based in the view of separation, of isolation, of insufficiency, of inner lack. This is the background view that those actions flow from. Now, we could say there's the realized view versus the assumed view, So a realized view is like when we directly see it through practice, sometimes through life events, we just, or inquiry, we see suddenly the sense of unity, the sense of non-division. We could also, though, practice like that's true. You know, have an assumption. Well, that's, a lot of people talk about that. I mean, how would I be in the world if that is reality, if that's how things actually are? And that sometimes invites a different way of relating and seeing yourself in relationship to the world. There's a sense of softening of those barriers, those boundaries. So that sense of oneness. So one way I want to try to kind of get a handle on this topic is sharing some of a couple of stories from when I was years ago, when I was a wilderness ranger for the Forest Service. And I bring these up just to kind of show the, you know, both the effects of wise intention and on our actions and our relationship to the world and how we relate to the world. And really the examples are just meant to be something that we can extrapolate into our own lives and into climate change, and also the time frame that climate change is happening. So those of you who may not be familiar with, when I say wilderness ranger, it's referring to someone who patrols the wilderness areas. And wilderness areas are a particular thing that was designated by Congress back in 1964, under the Wilderness Act. I was looking this up that back in 1964, the world population was 3.3 billion. And then as of this month, we're at 7.9 billion. So you can see the exponential growth of our fellow humans on this planet and the strain that has on the world. And how can we, and how that affects the have on the climate. So Wilderness Act, it's one of the most poetic acts of Congress. And some of the language here is very gendered. This is probably the style back then. So please excuse the use of the male pronoun. I'll just read a couple sentences from it. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. So as a visitor who does not remain, that sense of being untrammeled. And it generally appears to be affected primarily by the forces of nature, with the impact of man's work substantially unnoticed, and has substanding opportunities for solitude, or a primitive and unconfined type of recreation. So this is a preservation act. It's to set aside land that was being at risk of being gobbled up or used for other uses. And, you know, again, the sense of wilderness is a modern idea. You know, those cultures and people in the past and today who live very connected to the land and to the environment, even the idea of wilderness, they don't have a word for, because that's just their home. But from kind of a Western European model, it's like, okay, we have to kind of set aside this and see humans and the wilderness as separate. So looking back, I see, you know, that separation. But yet the wilderness is something that if you go out into the wilderness, a deep wilderness, and you're far from any planes, any automobiles, there's just simply the silence. They're just the nature is really untrammeled. It's simply doing its thing without concerns of us. And so part of my job on the ground was to educate people and help people around how to be low impact camping, things like where you pitch your tent and whether you should have campfire and how to protect the vegetation, you know, what to do with your waste and litter, all those kind of things. So what does this have to do with climate change and wise intention? So, you know, how we act, you know, like in something as simple as going out into the woods, how we act shows a background intention. You know, do we stay along the path or do we tramp through the meadows and cause damage? Do we set a fire in a very subalpine area that leaves a scar Or do we live in a much more conscious and much more gentle way in relationship to those lands? And I found, you know, in those years that the more connected a person was to the nature, to the sense of wilderness, the less they needed to alter the environment, the less they needed to change it. They simply were in harmony with it. They could relax into how things were. They didn't have to cut down three trees to build a structure or have a big fire to warm themselves, because they were open to the beauty that was right in front of them. There's that sense of sufficiency. So the acts of renunciation were very natural for them. On the other hand, the less connected they were, the less in touch they were with their own relationship to nature, the more they would try to alter their environment, you know, cutting down trees or building fires, stacking a bunch of rocks in this place or that way. And so those years of working for the Forest Service, you know, learned to travel more lightly on the land. And in a way that started to transform from the rules to actually really taking in that sensitivity of, you know, what is the lightest way I can move through the landscape? What's the way I could prevent myself from damaging the earth as little as possible? And of course, I struggle to overcome and to erase the damage of those who are less connected, the fire pits, the extra trails, the tree mutilation. And so with climate change, you know, there's this connection that's called for us. The more connected we are, the more we naturally renounce actions which cause harm, that cause damage. The more that since we recognize the wilderness within ourselves, the nature within ourselves, we naturally come forth that way. So with climate change, the trick, though, is it's not so obvious, the effect of our actions. It's not like right in front of our face. Like if I was a ranger and I came out and found you in your campsite, I could look at your campsite and almost immediately tell how connected you were, what your relationship to nature was, you know, how messy it was, how neat it was, how gentle it was in the land, or how destructive it might have been. I can infer by that how much you are driven by desire, by greed, you know, or how much renunciation that you take on, choosing to walk and camp lightly on the land. Now, with climate change, you know, it's much harder to see those direct effects of our actions, because it's kind of this accumulative effect. It's our cumulative actions of the 7.9 billion people. You know, from how our personal choices around our transportation, and how we heat and cool our homes, how we winterize, how we invest our money, how we influence and elect our government leaders. It's much harder to see that cause and effect, but it doesn't mean it's not there. It's still there. So practicing with renunciation, you know, connect with that sense of interconnection. You know, see, where is that sense of lack of separation? You know, where does that, that's a felt sense. It's not something that's out there. It's something that's just needs to be uncovered and revealed. And realizing that our actions matter, you know, both large and small. And the more we can rest in that sense of inner sufficiency, that sense of perfection in this moment, the renunciation that might be called is much easier, much more effortless. So a simple practice that we'll talk about for the homework this week is to look at a list of actions that you might take around climate change. And notice, connect with the sense of the greed versus renunciation spectrum. You know, where do I land at each of those actions? Because I think if we're honest, we all have those areas like, I'd rather kind of avoid that, changing that part of my life, because it's inconvenient. It's not helpful. But yet if we connect to that sense of interconnection, we see how even those small actions add up. It's a sense of curiosity around this renunciation. Now, the next wise intention is that of non-ill will. Now, let's revisit view for a moment. So when we come from a wise, from an unwise view, that of separation, of isolation, ill will makes complete sense. You know, it's logically follows from that. The other person is the other, is the one who's outside, someone who needs to be controlled or harmed if they get in my way or threaten me, take what's mine. You know, you might get in my way of filling my inner lack because there's only so much to go around. This is all language of separation, language of isolation. And this is what we are the most familiar with, if we are honest. And the same thing applies to nature, how we relate to nature. Like if we have that background stance of isolation and separation, that's naturally going to come forth in how we look at nature, how we relate to nature. And certainly our history as human beings is filled with ill will toward nature. You know, we overcome it, we beat it back, beat back the wilderness, put our needs first, not even considering, you know, what nature might need. Back in my Wilderness Ranger days, I remember this one time my partner and I were patrolling this alpine lake, and we, you know, had an area we didn't want to have any fires because it was a tree my height might take 100 years to grow. So there's a lot of, you know, regulations around that and also education around that. And we came to this lake after someone had built a fire and cut down this tree. And, you know, left the tree. It was a green tree, so it didn't burn very well. And we looked at the tree and counted the rings. And this tree, who was about 5 feet tall, I think it was a mountain hemlock, was 90 years old. It was almost 100 years old. Something that was very short. That attests to how slow the growing was each year, how short the growing cycle was. So my friend and I, being very passionate, hauled that tree down, trying to chase after the people we thought who had done it and to show them, to try to convince them of the impact of their actions. And this is this violence toward nature, this ill will toward nature. Another sad one was seeing a young bear who had been poached and was just skinned and just left there to rot, and just feeling the sorrow of that. And how, you know, again, the greed, the sense of insufficiency leads to this ill will, that nature just is something to overcome, to get rid of, to take what we want and not worry about the mess that's left. All supported by unwise view, and then unwise intention comes forth. So again, climate change, part of the trick is to start to see the perceived, again, the feedback isn't so immediate. It's not like right in front of us. It's our actions today will affect the lives of our children, of our grandchildren. They'll affect our lives, you know, in a number of years, but it's removed enough that it's not so obvious. And then until it's too late. You know, thinking back to the 1800s with the passenger pigeon. The passenger pigeons, the nesting grounds used to cover 850 square miles with an estimated, you know, 136 million pigeons. And John Muir described the passenger pigeons in flight. I've seen flocks streaming south in the fall so large that they were flowing from horizon to horizon in an almost continuous stream all day long. So stream, just imagine that the flocks, when they took flight, just from day, the whole day would be covering the sky. They were endless. They would never end. And yet humans, through their actions, through shotgun shells and trapping, clubbing, ended up, the last pigeon died in 1914. Okay, so a little bit of actions over time can have tremendous effect, especially when there's 7.9 million of us. strongest evidences of global warming, where the Earth is warming due to heat trap gases released by the burning of fossil fuels. So the message is there, that ill will is flowing out. It's having its effect. And so how can we wake up enough to see that, to make change in time? So both renunciation and non-ill will, you could see how they flow into the third wise intention, and that is of non-harm. This is perhaps what first comes to mind, like I want to have this sense of non-harm in my life, in my relationships, to my own inner life, my body, my mind, and to the environment. And wise, the sense of non-harm is really supported by our wise view, and also supported by the other wise intentions of renunciation and non-ill will. You know, so renunciation allows us to hopefully really see that inner lack is just an illusion, that there is a complete sufficiency in this moment. Not to say that we have needs, we have wants, we have things that are lacking in our lives. And there's also this sufficiency. So renunciation allows us to awake to that, to see that. So there's a natural letting go of our greed, of our hatred, the non-ill will. And then that allows us to support non-harm in our actions. However, when we base our view based on separation in the sense of duality, then harm is much more easily excused. It's more easily overlooked. We lash out when we feel threatened, when we feel attacked. We can justify harming the environment the same way, that sense of separation. And then when our view is based in interconnection, we realize that harming another is like harming ourselves. It's like harming ourselves, or harming, perhaps a better way to say it, harming a loved one, harming a child of ours. And so harming the environment feels like harming a child, harming our parents, harming ourselves. That's when that interconnection comes in. So non-harm becomes, again, a natural expression. It's been said that the fully awakened person, the fully awakened being, they no longer are capable of causing harm. They just doesn't make sense, because this interconnection is so clear that they harm someone else, they're really harming themselves. That the sense of unity, that sense of interconnection is a reality for them. And so we practice that. We practice that until that moment of complete awakening. Is how would I act from non-harm? How would I rediscover that sense of interconnection? Now, just as an aside, that I said that harming someone else, when we come from that place, or harming the environment, would be like harming ourselves. And yet, I think if we reflect, we do spend a lot of time harming ourselves, especially mentally and emotionally, maybe even physically. And it's because we relate to ourselves as divided. We divide it among different parts, the parts we like, the parts we don't like. It's the same symptom of the same underlying unwise view. But that's for another talk. So harm we can often cause unintentionally, and we don't realize that we're causing the harm, not understanding the impacts or the dynamics. And many of the people that I talked to and encountered as a wilderness stranger didn't understand the impact of their actions. They didn't understand that, camping on a field of heather, that would cause that heather to die because it was a woody stem. Not understanding that grass was much more durable or bare soil. They didn't understand how slow the growing season was above timberline. When there's just so much snow and so little chance for the growing season. So they're well-meaning but ignorant. And so part of my job was to try to connect with them and help them see the fragility of those areas. To understand, the value of wilderness, and how that's such a beautiful resource. And hopefully in a way that transformed their view, not just their actions while I was present, but something that was much more deep and long-lasting. And so too with climate change is how do we understand how our actions create harm or non-harm? You know, how can we start to perceive that? Partly, we need to learn to think more abstractly and extrapolate, because again, it's not this one-to-one feedback. It's not such a clear feedback. And yet, this day and age, we don't really have much excuse because the knowledge is so prevalent. It's so easily accessible. Just do a search on how to prevent climate change, and the internet will give you many beautiful resources. There's resources on the Sims website, and the Climate Action Group can also offer and point directions. So yet we sometimes do, overlook that. We forget to look, or we have other things which are more pressing. And so let's bring that into our practice for this week. Okay, that sense of, okay, I know what I should do, but, why aren't I doing some of those things? What is the hesitation? So ideally, we start with wise view. We have that deep sense of interconnection, that sense of non-separation. And then wise intention naturally forms from that, based on renunciation, on non-ill will, non-harm. And then our actions flow from that. It's very easy, it's very direct, it's very smooth, that whole direction. It becomes really difficult to do some action which is not lined up with our view. But in practice, because we're not all fully enlightened beings, it's helpful to start with our actions or our lack of actions and say, okay, let me just pause there for a moment. So often we quickly jump like, I need to do this, and I judge myself for not doing it. But does that really help you actually motivate you? So let's start, do a little bit of Dharma inquiry in this process. So notice an action, like maybe give it the list of the 10 or 12 things that you can do as just a householder around climate change. And if you read those, say, okay, I'm doing that one, that one. It's like, oh, okay, that one I don't know if I'm going to do right now. That's kind of inconvenient. Those are the ones to pause with, to kind of bring some interest in, some inquiry. Take time with those ones that feel there's resistance, there's a stickiness. And get a sense of what the intention is behind that. What's the natural action that you have around that? And then see, okay, what comes up around that? What's the underlying view that might be revealed? So I hope you get a sense of that. This is a theme that I love to teach about, is that we have an action, an impulse to do something. If we learn to pause with that action, it actually reveals this whole background level of what's motivating that, what's driving it. Our ignorance, we can look at our ignorance, we can look at our view, we can look at our intention, we can look at our sense of selfing, inner lack, all these different elements that are driving our actions. Because we do something for a reason. There's some motivation, some way it serves us. And if we don't rush to judge it and overcome it, we can actually learn something very deep about ourselves. Because whenever our actions are off, it's helpful to look at wise intention, what our intention is, what our view is, and what's operating from that. Wrong view will have that quality of separation and isolation, and the actions will flow from that and make sense. While wise view, wise intention, that sense of deeply understanding the interconnection between not only me and another person, not only me and the children and their children and the generations that come after that, but also my relationship to the earth. When that connection is really fully felt and reflected on and deep and allowed to really start to flush out, to blossom, then notice how your intentionality naturally starts to line up with that. That naturally you have this intention, okay, I think I'll let that action go. I will, maybe have less, have the heater down in my house less, or drive less, or fly less. Naturally, renunciation naturally flows from that versus I should do it. It's a very different motivation. Ill will. Noticing how you relate to pests, to things which are in your way in the natural world. Feeling that sense of interconnection, there's a very different set of actions that arises. And the same thing with non-harm. How interconnection, non-harm makes, is what makes sense. It's what is the obvious choice. It's the one that allows that sense of alignment, that sense of resonance to come all the way back through wise intention and into wise view. All right, thank you for your kind attention. And let's just sit for a moment or two, letting those words settle. All right, before we open to any comments or questions you might have, I want to just talk about the homework for this week. So go over a list of climate change actions you could implement. You know, these are potential ones that you maybe aren't doing. Again, the Sims website has some. It's very easy to find, you know, very many lists on the internet. And notice as you read that list, which ones kind of spark a little resistance in you. It's like, oh, I don't know about that one. And the ones that you feel, okay, I'm already doing or I'm excited about doing, those are good to know and continue with. But notice the ones that have the resistance. And without judging that resistance, reflect on wise intention. Again, renunciation, non-ill will, non-harm, and wise view, the sense of interconnection. And ask, is this resistance rooted in an unwise view or unwise intention? And just kind of play that idea. What's my background assumption as I contemplate this action? And reflect on what could help you shift your view and intention so the action becomes more accessible. Right? So hopefully that makes sense, and I think next week we'll explore that, you know, do a recap talk and do some small groups. All right, so we have some chance for any comments, questions, sharing, both about this topic or anything else in your practice is also welcome. And we'll have a chance for some announcements and also talk about the Climate Action Group here at Sims. Okay, David, I see that you're raised your blue hand. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I don't know if I can get the words right because I may get it wrong. But early on in the talk, you're talking about renunciation as just say it's something like allowing something to be as it is. Does that ring a bell?
Yes. Yeah, I think.
Can you say more? Because like that was just like a different angle. I always think of it as like kind of getting rid of or letting go, or like has more of a denial connotation than that. And so I was interested.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, David. So the sense of renunciation is often thought of as that's okay. I have to let go of this, I have to get this out of my life, or, you know, relinquish this thing that I really want or like in my life. And that sense of, I think you said
spirit of that, yeah.
Like, yes, yeah, that's that spirit. Now, there's a deeper way to look at renunciation, and that's that sense of not focusing on the object, but much more kind of our relationship to that object, and particularly kind of what that relationship is based in. So what I mean by that is, let's say there's something that I really, really like and enjoy, but also isn't so helpful or so skillful in my life, right? So I can say, okay, I'm going to let go of that. I'm not going to do it anymore. But it's kind of like, it's not really doing the work. It's not really seeing that inner release. And if I look more closely at what that nature of why I'm so attracted, or why do I still want to do that activity? If I go underneath the layer of that object, and the kind of the urge to satisfy that, I can start to sense kind of the deeper insufficiency that's driving that, the sense of deeper kind of almost existential lack that I'm trying to fill. Okay, I've picked this object A, object B. I'm trying all these different strategies to try to fill this inner lack. And I keep forgetting to notice that they don't really fill it. It's like, maybe the next time that will do it. That wasn't quite right. And we have this kind of, you know, ignorance or delusion that we kind of keep this cycling. Now, when we connect with that sense of inner lack, and then actually, you know, first it gets really painful because it's this kind of core insufficiency. But eventually we start to see that actually that's just a mistake in relationship to life. That's wrong view. And again, not intellectual, this is not an intellectual process, this is a direct seeing of it. You start to say, well, what's actually wrong right now in this very moment? And as your mind relaxes the need to get something, to obtain something, there's a settling into this moment. And in that way, you're really allowing things to be just how they are. So it's really pointing to transforming that essential relationship to life. How we so often ask life to fulfill our needs, to fulfill our lack. And really that lack is ours to see through. You know, really liberating the world from us.
That's great. Thank you. That's good.
Thank you, David. All right. So you can either raise your virtual hand or you can just unmute yourself. And if I miss somebody, you can let me know. All right, Clay, go ahead.
I guess kind of a comment that I'd love to hear you speak to is, I think with climate change in particular, my mind, I often notice it gets very overwhelmed with all of the things I could do and the knowledge that no matter what I do, just by being alive, I'm doing some harm. I'm eating food. Taking transportation, all that stuff. And I know that's not correct logically and sort of spiritually, because it's not all or nothing and I can make an impact, but that's often where my mind goes, and it often leads to indifference or giving up. You kind of touched on that, but just something I've noticed.
Yeah, that's, I think, glad you brought it up. That's a nice articulation of something that I've felt myself, and I think many people feel that it's, just feel like it's already too late. There's too much to do. I already caused too much damage just by being born. And, you know, it's hopeless. If you can feel that way. And then we become paralyzed and we give up and end up not doing anything. So it's that, you know, where's that edge of having enough urgency? Having enough urgency to act without becoming overwhelmed by it. Were you here last week?
Can't remember. I might have missed.
I know you're here on Thursday, so I forget which day you're here.
Yeah, me too, kind of.
So I talked about, in terms of addiction, I talked about kind of three ways to work with that. And one of them was to reflect on the fact that we're mortal, you know, that using death as an advisor. And that is also something that can be really overwhelming, that can be too much to hold. And right, and I suggest it is fine. Where's that sweet spot that gives you the energy to act and to really, in that case, to really let go of the addiction and really live life versus and not become complacent and not become overwhelmed? Like, okay, let's say you have a year to live. Okay, I got 10 years to live. I can kind of mess around for a while. I got a year. Okay, I'm going to start to be more serious. You know, I got 6 months. Okay, I'm going to be more serious. I get down to a month. I start to get more panic going. And then I kind of gone over that edge. So I think it might be a similar thing with climate change, is to say, okay, how can I simplify this problem so there's something that I can have, I can feel good about my actions. And so you might just pick the direction of this night's talk was a little different direction, but you know, to speak to what you're talking about, and I think it'd be very helpful to voice that. is if we feel that sense of overwhelm, is say, okay, let me focus on just one thing that I can change. And really reflect on how, okay, I'm making this choice. You know, this is a lifestyle choice. It's a intentional choice. And how this is, I'm doing my little bit toward changing the climate, to changing the you know, to reversing climate change. And reflecting on that and having that sense of kind of, you know, feeling good about yourself that you're doing that action. And in that way, it starts to build more energy. And paradoxically, you can actually do more things. And so a lot of it is really learning to work with our mind and finding, you know, where's that sweet spot that we pay attention and we act, but not becoming overwhelmed and paralyzed. And yeah, this is, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's a really important point. Right, does that help, Clay?
Definitely. Yeah. I just remember the very beginning of COVID when everyone was talking about washing their hands. And so I was like trying to wash my hands like 10 times a day. And at first I had very negative associations with it. I'm like, I don't want to get sick. I don't, you know, all this stuff. And it just made me feel very overwhelmed because I was like, well, inevitably there, I'm going to touch something and then not wash my hands and touch my face and get COVID, blah, blah, blah. But then the reframe I did was kind of, well, don't think about that. Don't think of the negative, think of the positive. Like I thought of like, as I was washing my hands, I was like, this is an act of love, not for me, not just for me, but for everyone else. And that really helps. And I think with this also, maybe for me, like focusing on the positive, like I'm having a positive impact rather than just mitigating the negative, I think helps me too.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, beautiful. Think of it as your actions as a gift to the rest of humanity and the rest of the world. It's like, well, I'm making this little choice. It seems like a small gift, but it's a significant gift. And if we had, you know, a certain percentage of people doing that, you know, it would fix the problem. So, it's really the art of how do we work with our minds, and that's beautiful. Yeah, think of it as a gift. Think of it as a way of helping others. Thank you, Clay. All right. Anyone else have anything they'd like to share? Ellie, I see you put a chat, but I don't quite know what that means. So if you like to elaborate, you can, or we can leave it at that.
Sure. This is Ellie, and it's very similar to what Clay and you were saying, is there's so many things out there. It's okay to say, this is what I'm feeling drawn to do. And my intention is bringing me to that point. And it's okay to focus on that which is calling me, and other things will transpire. So what is mine to do is like the first step towards more and more.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So if you became overwhelmed, there's too much to do and you end up doing nothing, that's not a good thing. But if you pick one thing that, okay, I can do this. And then again, if you reflect and I am making a difference. I am doing something for the planet, for the future generations, that will bring the energy up. So maybe I can add another one, in a few months or something like that. Right. That's it. Yeah.
And if I can say, because if I'm particularly called to one aspect, then I'm more apt to connect with it rather than something that I'm, you know that I should do, but I'm not really drawn to it. So it makes my inner intention more visceral, more alive. And then another thing will transpire. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's really important. What we're naturally drawn to, we're much more lined up already with that. And we just have to kind of enhance that and really let that cultivate and develop. And that has its own a way of building something else. So thank you for sharing that, Ellie. All right, what else is out there in the Zoom world?
Tim, I don't know, just I'm thinking of it. You know, what recommendations do you have for kind of how to broach this conversation with others? Because I think it's one of those topics, like a lot of political topics, where you don't want to come across as judgmental, right? And sort of condescending or mostly just judgmental. So maybe the answer is don't judge. but I'm curious how you kind of have those conversations with people, because you want to spread the word and you want to influence other people because you can magnify your own impact too.
Yeah, it's a really important question, because we can, depending on how we approach it, we can cause more alienation and more people digging in their heels, or we could really inspire and, you know, really make a difference. So, I mean, it's similar to what we were talking about with, you know, your question and Ellie's, you know, question and comment. It's just that sense of, okay, what's one thing that you can do? Because, you know, sometimes it is that sense of overwhelm. You know, sometimes it's, you know, a sense of disagreement about what the facts are. There's sometimes that's the issue. So I think it's always helpful to start by, you know, doing a lot of listening and kind of let the other person kind of voice what they're feeling, what they're doing. And, you know, often that leads to, like, they ask you, what's your take on this? And then you might have an invitation to actually go in versus, you know, chasing down people in a big, big truck spewing gas and say, hey, what are you doing? You know, I mean, sometimes that's the approach, but it's, and also, you know, I encourage you to look at the Climate Action Group, because they have, you know, I think that's something that they talk about. You know, how do you bring that message forth? And that's probably be a good segue, Iris, if you'd like to talk about that. So thank you, Clay.
Thank you, Tim. Hi, everybody. My name is Iris, and I'm a member of SIMS's Climate Action Group. And Tim has generously offered some time for me to speak a bit about it. And I'm very heartened by the questions and the comments that several of you have offered, because it's very clear that people are interested in this topic, and possibly you don't know that SIMS has an active climate action group. So our group began 3 years ago in May of 2018, with the mission to address climate change in all of the ways we can. And this has meant educating ourselves, exploring individual and group actions to participate in, and sometimes joining with other groups to enhance our actions. And some of the actions we've engaged in have been to ask Tim to give an annual climate-related Dharma talk. This is the third annual one during Earth Day week. We've had follow-up discussions after his talks. We had a documentary film viewing, followed by small group discussions. Several of us marched together in the Climate March in September of 2019. We presented an online event last July, 2020, with presentations from several of our members about the ways in which we were personally addressing the climate crisis, from things such as planting trees to educating others about plant-based diets to lobbying for good climate legislation and learning more about environmental justice issues. Also, several of us participated in a months-long training called the EcoSattva training, which is given by a DC-based sangha called One Earth Sangha. And we presented what we learned from that training in last year's July event. Our group continues to look for ways to support and partner with other groups by joining in letter-writing campaigns. And we're currently looking at supporting a decarbonizing buildings project with another, actually, faith-based group. We also facilitated SIMS to co-sponsor with Dharma Friendship Foundation, a Tibetan Buddhist Sangha in Seattle, a forum series with a diverse group of monthly guest speakers, including a Rinpoche, indigenous storytellers, a Zen climate scientist, and others. And on our new website, under the tab entitled Engaged Buddhism, there's a separate tab for the Climate Action Group with resources such as our Guidelines for a Livable Planet, which is based loosely off of the precepts, as well as our Climate Buddies program. We also have a SIMS Climate Action Group bulletin board online that has many more resources that can be accessed by anyone who's on the group's email list. And if you're interested in having access to the bulletin board, I invite you to get on the email list, even if you're not interested in attending our meetings. Speaking of the meetings, we have met every month since May 2018. And I'd like to say that probably the most important thing to me about our group is really just us coming together in a shared space around a tremendously important and difficult set of issues, and providing support, encouragement, appreciation, ideas, respect, and love to each and for each other. And it really helps to make difficult work joyful. And I think that Ken was going to drop into our chat. And Ken, I'm not sure if you're in the meeting. Here we go. Excellent. Thank you. The mission statement for our group, which is a lot more eloquent than I just was. But before I go on to our usual announcements, I guess if it's okay with you, Tim, you know, I would just like to, if anybody has a question right now for me, I'm happy to answer. And if not, you can get hold of me via our website. I'm one of the board members. So I hope that I addressed what our climate group wanted me to. So shall I go ahead with announcements now, Tim?
We can pause for a moment, see if there's any questions.
And I do want to say, you know, Ellie, that what you said about acting on something that really calls to you is, you know, is a beautiful way to start this process. We can't do everything, but we can all do something.
And I just have to say that what Tim said was, be loving and notice the things that are hard for you. And that is where the shadow lies. And to it's a great practice to notice what is not there or that is scary for you. So that's really exciting to me.
Thank you. Yeah. And also, Clay, your sort of spin on feeling the joy in doing something positive and understanding that those efforts are not only for oneself, but for everyone. Really quite beautiful.
And Iris, a question came in. Are people able to join the group, the CAD group?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How would they do that?
They would do that by letting either me or Ken know. Ken, would you be willing to put into the chat the easiest way for people to get in touch with us and join the group? We meet, and we've been meeting, of course, on Zoom for the last year. We meet the second Tuesday night of every month from 7 to 8:30. And we actually had a new member join us last week, or whenever the second Tuesday was, and we would love new members. Yeah. So I think that Ken will put into the chat a way to join our group. But if you go to our website, under the Engaged Buddhism tab, there's a sub tab called Climate Action Group. And if you click on that, you can join the group. So Ken, you don't have to do anything. I just answered the question.
Yeah, there's a link there so that you can email either one of us, either Iris or myself.
Yeah. And again, you know, we would love to have people participating as much as you're comfortable. And even if you don't want to actively participate, getting on the email list gives you access to our bulletin board, and it's replete with resources and all sorts of good information.
Okay, should we move on to the announcements?
Okie dokie.
Thank you, Iris.
And thank you so much, Tim, for your talk. It was wonderful, and I know our whole group so appreciates you you doing it. Yeah. So I'm on the board, and so I'm giving announcements tonight. The first one is that our Buddhist Essentials series is ongoing, with the second in the series happening this Wednesday night, the 21st. The series is taught by our local Dharma leaders, and there will be 2 day-longs associated with the series, the first being on July 24th and the second later in the year. On Saturday, this Saturday, the 24th, there will be a day-long retreat taught by two of our local Dharma leaders, Suze Appel and Steve Wilhelm, entitled Finding Freedom in Impermanence and Not Self, and the class is from 9 to 4:30. You can register online. On May 15th, there will be a day of mindfulness that Tim will lead, and it will be capping off the intro to meditation class that is currently ongoing. On May 22nd and 23rd, we're having a non-residential retreat with a guest teacher, Narayan Helen Liebenson, a long-term friend of and co-teacher with Rodney Smith and now with Tim Guile. And the theme of the weekend is understanding and living the Four Noble Truths. Narayan's a wonderful, warm, and experienced teacher. You can register online. The forum series that I alluded to in my comments about the Climate Action Group, co-sponsored by SIMS and the Dharma Friendship Foundation, is continuing. The series is entitled Interdependence and Our Ecological Crisis, Responding with Wisdom, Compassion, and Justice. And we have 3 more scheduled events upcoming on April 24th, May 22nd, and June 12th with guest teachers. And you can find out more information and register at dharmafriendship.org. Unfortunately, some of these events are scheduled when other SIMS events are planned. However, the events are recorded and available for viewing afterwards on Dharma Friendship's YouTube site. Tim already mentioned our survey, so I won't say anything further about that. Please fill it out if you haven't. We really value your input. And the SIMS board has begun planning efforts around a number of key areas that are important to the future of SIMS. These areas include community engagement, volunteering, Sangha life, communications and marketing, and finance. We really would like your help to help us visualize the future of SIMS. If you're interested in helping, please see the volunteer page of our website where we've posted more details. And finally, I want to remind you all of the importance of Donna and generously supporting SIMS and our teachers. Not meeting in person and so not seeing the physical Donna baskets makes it easier to forget that it's up to all of us to keep SIMS going. And we understand that our monthly donations link wasn't working for a while. We fixed this and moved from Braintree to Stripe, and this option is now working well. Please donate online. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Iris, and thank you all for your engagement and your generosity. And next week we'll have a recap of this talk and some small group discussions.